I was with the same Catherine Sobel once as we were traveling near Palm Springs, where all the windmills are. And she said, Cliff, you see out there? That is where we used to come and gather every year. We would gather the fruit from the barrel cactus, and we loved to come here, and we had such fun. But when they put in these wind machines, they brought in bulldozers, and they leveled everything and destroyed every one of those plants. And we're no longer allowed to go there, even if there were barrel cactus.
Yeah.
So the people have lost their native foods, and with the loss of native foods then comes disease. It makes their bodies susceptible because the diet, the present modern-day diet of native folks is not what they grew up eating and biologically for thousands of years eating a particular type of diet, and then it's changed so radically it just opens up the body to infection.
Absolutely. And of course we I'm looking at the clock here.
Peace.
And
this is MF Grimm. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This feels like home being here. Keep hip-hop alive.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual end-of-year campaign. You can help us meet our $75,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $20,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. Thanks so much for your support.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammack and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about shows and festivals coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to archive shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and also via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7, right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
KBOO FM, Portland, power to the people.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Janata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Janata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. On today's show, we'll be talking, about the controversies over speech on campus, about the use and abuses and histories of words like sabotage, about the ways people with money in Portland try to ignore and drown out the voices of the majority. Talk on mainstream commercial media clouds up what's really going on, distorts the picture, but KBOO is a beacon of light cutting through all that, cutting through the clouds. So before we turn to all that good talk on today's episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour, here's a quick reminder that this is the last week of KBOO's end-of-year campaign. We have only a few days left to reach our $75,000 goal, but your contribution now will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000, thanks to the generous support of a group of KBOO donors. So go to kboo.fm/give, or if you're using the KBOO mobile app, just click on the donate button. By SMS, you can text KBOO to 44321, or you can write a check and postal mail it to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Lots of ways to support us in getting the word out on community-powered radio. And if you need a last-minute holiday gift, you can give someone a KBOO membership and give yourself a deduction on your 2023 taxes. On today's show, we'll hear Jan Hocken talking with Professor Jennifer Ruth, a professor and associate dean at Portland State University, who's published extensively on issues of academic freedom, free speech issues, and campus politics. They'll be talking about the political dynamics of that spectacle earlier this month in which a U.S. congressional committee grilled three prominent university presidents in a hearing supposedly about, quote, holding campus leaders accountable and confronting anti-Semitism, end quote, but that seemed to preclude any speech about the current genocide in Palestine or the rights of students or academic experts to comment on that, instead trying to elicit loyalty oaths to another nation-state. Then, Joe Clement and I will be discussing the 2022 film How to Blow Up a Pipeline, inspired by the 2021 book of the same title. We'll talk about the possible rhetorical effects of that incendiary title, about what gets called terrorism, and about what's called for in the fight against the fossil fuel corporations so politely killing life on Earth. Finally today, we'll hear from lawyer, researcher, and guest mole Lauren Goldberg about the ways that citizen-initiated ballot measures are the voice of the people in Portland seeking things like equitable education and health care and climate policy, and how big business interests in the city cloud those issues by devoting their ample resources to obstructing what voters have worked for. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find a link to subscribe to our show. If you're interested in getting involved with the Mole, or if you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. And remember, you can support your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered, nonprofit community radio station by clicking on the red Donate tab on the app or in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm. First up, Jan Hocken talking with Professor Jennifer Ruth about just how authoritarian things have gotten when the U.S. Congress is badgering university presidents.
Welcome to KBOO, Jennifer Ruth. Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Jan. You're a professor in the School of Film and Associate Dean of the College of the Arts at Portland State University, and much of your scholarship focuses on controversies around academic freedom. You have several books on the topic, including The Right to Learn, Resisting the Right-Wing Attack on Academic Freedom, a very timely volume, which will be coming out in early 2024. So it's delightful to have you on the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning to offer your insights on the drama that unfolded at a congressional hearing earlier this month. The presidents of Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the University of Pennsylvania, all women who were fairly new to their positions, were grilled during a four-hour congressional hearing titled Holding Campus Leaders Accountable and Confronting Anti-Semitism. And assuming their call for accountability were directed to these three women presidents of prestigious universities in this country. And a wave of condemnations followed the hearing with vociferous calls for their resignations. So how would you describe what was happening at this congressional hearing? What were some of the political dynamics in play?
Well, it was very disturbing. It felt very much like political theater. It felt very much like echo of what we remember with the McCarthy hearings. And we're not yet at a point where a Claudine Gay can say, have you no decency? Maybe in a few months, someone will be able to flip the tables a little bit and reframe things or that's more in a more honest way.
There's a press for loyalty oaths.
Right now, there's not space for that. And there's not enough of a digestion of what's going on and an impatience with a kind of political interference that for some people sort of looks like we're sleepwalking into authoritarianism or even tyranny. But yeah, I mean, I think with the loyalty oaths, for one, the way that the entire hearings were framed, You know, if you're on campuses, you're hearing from students who are concerned about longstanding injustices in Gaza and the West Bank. You're hearing from students who have been thinking about boycott, divest, and sanctions, and who do see a parallel between the boycotting of universities around South African apartheid and the segregation and the cordoning off and sort of surveillance state that Israel has over it in its occupation.
Just to insert a point there, it's not only students organizing around those lines of analysis, but there's an established line of scholarship.
Oh, absolutely.
Around absolutely. The same lines of analysis.
When you come out of that context, the fact that there is no mention of justice in statelessness, the nation state system, I'm not even going to say colonialism, but there's no context in which what's happening from the lens of the Palestinian is possible to be expressed in the hearings, because it's a hearing about anti-Semitism. And people were able, Democratic congressional leaders and the presidents of the universities were able to throw in words like Islamophobia here and there, anti-Arab hate. But by and large, there was no way, given how they were framed, to get at the historical situation that is bringing the students to the streets. So instead, when it gets framed exclusively around anti-Semitism, the Republicans can take the line that we're seeing, and they did, and there was, to a certain extent, this line was completely accepted and became a kind of truth within the hearing, that there's a huge scourge of anti-Semitism, a rise of a resurgence of long-standing, long, you know, almost ahistorical, right? Ahistorical anti-Semitism. And there's literally no context in which someone can mention the Nakba. There's no context in which someone can mention what it's like to be in a refugee camp for generations. So all of that was erased, and precisely because of the way the hearings were staged as around anti-Semitism, and then the opening gambit by Representative Virginia Fox was to ask, as you mentioned, for loyalty oaths. She asked each of the presidents, do you believe in the existence of Israel as a Jewish nation? I thought it was very interesting that the president, and I think it was Claudine Gay, who first kind of landed on as a kind of way to handle the fact that they were going to be gamed throughout. They were being gamed. And how do you answer these questions under that circumstance? She said, I believe that Israel has a right to exist. So she didn't say, I believe that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish nation. Which has
over a century of controversy, including among Jews around that.
Absolutely. Each president then just echoed what I believe it was Claudine Gay saying first. So they each had to sort of attest to the right of Israel to exist without any ability to contextualize the fact that there's many, many different imaginations around in what form it exists, whether it's established now, whether it was established in violence, or whether it was established through the UN. There are people who would say it shouldn't have come into existence the way that it did, but now that it does, we have to deal with it as a reality and have, you know, two-state system or whatever. To the two-state system, a binational, none of those terms. Palestinian, that term itself probably appears once in the entire transcript of the hearings. Before Fox asked for the loyalty oath, she asked for a moment of silence for the 1,400 victims. And then throughout the transcript, the Congress people who are trying to sort of gotcha to the presidents are mentioning babies being beheaded. They're talking about the women being raped. So the graphic violence of what happened to the 1,400 victims is repeatedly being invoked. And there's not one mention of the killing of innocent civilians in Gaza. And by the time of the hearings, I'm not sure what figure we were at in terms of how many people had died, how many children and babies and women had died in Gaza. I don't know.
15,000, but
there was not one mention of that.
Can you say a bit about how you approach academic freedom?
In the culture wars, they're always conflated, academic freedom and free speech. So you have people, you constantly see them paired and not differentiated. But for the sake of sort of background that may or may not become important in talking about this issue in the hearings, academic freedom really speaks to scholars and professors and teachers' right to explore their and to develop their expertise, to not have the state, politics or politicians, not have money, donors, or the local chemical company that doesn't want the biologist testing the water in the area, to have all of those outside influences kept at bay and allow the academics to pursue knowledge, pursue truth freely without coercion or interference.
Well, and of course, those forces are in play, and including in this very drama that followed.
The pressure from donors, the sort of, I will withdraw billions of dollars of donations if you don't resign or if this isn't handled, that's enormous pressure. And of course, it's been a fantasy all along that tenure or the term academic freedom really buys you that kind of freedom from interference. But conceptually, it's very important. And there are at times different ways to create firewalls, or at least to try to honor the principle that money should not buy knowledge or shape knowledge or in both regards, it shouldn't shut down knowledge, and nor should people be opportunists. This too is something that unfortunately is often practiced in the breach, which is the idea that we have salaries, so we don't need the chemical companies to pay us huge speaking fees to talk about how climate change is a hoax, right? That's the idea. It doesn't always play out that way. So while it's not ever been pure, and universities have always been shaped by both outside forces of the state, nationalism, and industrial, you know, billionaires. And
increasingly depend on donors as well as tuition money.
Yeah, it's absolutely been, at least with public universities, the shift has been from less and less federal and state subsidies and more dependence on donors and private interests and money. Yeah, so that's a big problem, and you want to disentangle speech that's been coerced. And so the problem becomes, and that's always been talked about in terms of the credibility of universities. So the fact that the presidents are being put in this position, like Liz McGill, where the board of trustees resigns and she resigns under the threat of money being taken back or withheld from the university, money that could go into all kinds of important and necessary and useful research. But the fact that those resignations happen under those kinds of threats and pressures raises questions on academic integrity, credibility of institutions. The integrity of the institution is supposed to be based in part on the perception that it's keeping at bay special interests, and it's looking at the world objectively, and it's empowering its scholars to look at the world objectively. But so academic freedom speaks to the production of knowledge and the dissemination of knowledge. It also speaks to intramural and extramural speech, but I don't think that's necessary to go into.
Free there are responsibilities as well as rights that come, or freedoms that come with that.
Here's the difference. Free speech, First Amendment. The First Amendment and notions of free speech are completely predicated on the idea that we are a democracy in which the state should not be controlling its citizens' speech. The democracy only has legitimacy if citizens are able to criticize, able to dissent, able to offer their own opinions on issues, able to influence public opinion. So that a democracy that's responsive to its citizenry requires free speech.
And justification for the limits. And that seemed to be more what was at stake here in the hearings, rights of students, as I read it.
Well, but let me finish about the difference between the question where responsibilities come up is that with free speech, you don't want to put any limits except incitement to violence, except for threats, except for harassment, speech that is severe, pervasive, there's threats of harm involved. You can put limits on that, but the limits around the integrity of the speech, you can't put those kinds of limits on free speech. You can put them on academic freedom. So with free speech, the quality of the opinion, you can't control it, because you need citizens to be able to feel free to say, if they want to spout a conspiracy theory, they can spout a conspiracy theory. If you have an academic, a historian of Germany, who's spouting a conspiracy theory that the Holocaust is a hoax, you can fire that academic. That's not protected speech under academic freedom. If he's someone on the street corner, doesn't have a degree and isn't being sort of held up as an expert by an institution, he can say the Holocaust is a hoax and he can't be thrown in jail. He can't be thrown in jail as an academic, but he shouldn't be able to continue to teach either.
Yeah. So was this a displacement in a way by going after the most outrageous example of speech acts, a distraction from maybe the real issues on campuses around lines of scholarship, academic lines of scholarship that have been established that are critical of Israeli policies, and that they get swept into this, the moral panic of the return of calls for a Holocaust? You know, there really are a different set of issues that are more directly taken up now in academia about the scholarship of Palestinian studies, critiques of Israel, and so on.
Well, I think that takes us back to the question of, to what extent is this an extension of narratives that have already been sort of aggressively pushed in the culture wars, and to what extent is this a new dynamic? Because if you think about before October 7th, what the right-wing politicians, that it was most sort of flagrant and visible in Texas and in Florida, but there was legislative bills being proposed in Senates and houses all over the country. But there was an attack on Black studies, ethnic studies, gender studies. There's an attack on identity politics, then the idea that, and there's a lot of language around it being divisive, a lot of language around these forms of study being tribal in some way and creating and polarizing and responsible for the polarization of America. I don't think any of that is fair at all. I mean, it would take a very, you know, sort of Casaubon-like sociological study to map out all the reasons why we're in the state we're in America at this moment in relationship to being unable to sort of agree on some basic truths across differences. So I certainly wouldn't hold those departments responsible for them, but they were going after them, and they were going after them as unpatriotic, as causing discomfort for white students. So there were already these narratives, and then the transcripts of the hearing, you see, and this is what I meant earlier when I said that sometimes you sort of admire the presidents for not answering one question because they can see how it's being set up for another. Repeatedly, Stefanik, but also others, repeatedly they say, now a call for a mass execution of African Americans on your campus would be a problem, right? Or a call for, you know, they bring up race as in Black, white, American race relations. So then one congressperson, not Stefanik, says, well, a neo-Nazi wouldn't be welcome on your campus, right? And the irony is that the neo-Nazi, it's as if they're saying in the same kind of pattern that they've been setting up race relations in the states to then go after anti-Semitism, then sort of say you're a hypocrite because you have been controlling speech around race when it comes to African Americans. You've been supporting Black Lives Matter. You've been doing reverse racism, all of the stuff that we saw in the right-wing culture wars and the DeSantis stuff before October 7th. They're setting them up to sort of say, yeah, I have a problem with a neo-Nazi on my campus in the context of race. But of course, a neo-Nazi is also in the context of anti-Semitism and Charlottesville. So there's these weird twists and turns that happen. But what the president typically did was say, I would find those values against the institution's values, but we have a wide berth. Because they knew that the Congress people were trying to do is catch them in some kind of hypocritical moment. And they refused to be caught in that moment. But then it looked lawyerly, it looked cagey, it looked bureaucratic.
Well, I think it's refreshing to hear some praise for these beleaguered presidents, even though I'm sure they're getting paid well and will survive on their feet. But it's also speaks volumes to people on the more on the periphery, academic periphery of these more elite schools. So I'd love to have you back on the Old Mole again as we continue to take this up and perhaps talk about the book coming out early next year, The Right to Learn, Resisting the Right Wing Attack on Academic Freedom. Can you just say briefly when that'll be available?
Yeah, it'll be out with Beacon Press in April.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we will definitely have you on the show. Thank you so much, Jennifer Ruth, for joining me today on the Old Mole Variety Hour to talk about the congressional hearings, holding campus leaders accountable and confronting anti-Semitism, and your insights on what that was all about.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give the fascist man a gunshot. In old Vienna, under heavy manners. What's going on? What the hell is going on? We all stood waiting for the tide to turn. A history lesson that we forgot to learn. Screw the word,
screw the word.
Nice to suit. Don't be fooled,
they're still wearing check boots.
The words get tired when you hear them every day. The Nazis changed, but they never went away.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. We just heard some of Enough is Enough, Kick It Over by Chumbawamba. And before that, Jan Hocken talking with Professor Jennifer Ruth about what kinds of speech are free and what kinds of freedom are academic and why the right is so agitated about universities. Later on today's show, we'll hear from guest mole Lauren Goldberg about how agitated the Portland big business lobby gets against democracy because it might reduce the amount of wealth they can extract from the people of the city. Okay, that's my framing, not hers. I don't want to cloud things up because KBOO is about cutting through the clouds and illuminating the world. And let me thank everyone who has supported KBOO's annual end-of-year campaign. We have just a few more days to meet our $75,000 goal to keep the lights on and the equipment working and the website running and the staff supporting the hundreds of volunteers who have been making KBOO happen for the past 55 years. If you give this week, your donation to KBOO will be doubled by matching funds from a generous group of KBOO donors up to $20,000. So go to kboo.fm/give or click on the red donate button on the app or the website or text KBOO to 44321. Or mail your check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Give a little, give a lot, give once, give monthly as a sustaining member. But give. Give now to your volunteer-powered, member-supported, non-commercial community radio station. Next up on today's Old Mole Variety Hour, Joe Clement and I are talking about the movie How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
In 2021, Swedish scholar activist Andreas Malm published How to Blow Up a Pipeline, a book that is not an instruction manual and does not actually call for blowing up pipelines, but does argue for greater militancy in the climate movement, chiefly in the form of blockades, occupations, climate camps, similar mass direct action. In 2022, director Daniel Goldhaber, screenwriters Ariella Barrer and Jordan Scholl, and editor Daniel Garber released a film loosely inspired by Malm's book. It takes the provocative title, the general idea that causing property damage is morally justified in the fight against climate change, and not much else. It's a fictional thriller using the genre of the heist film, showing a ragtag group of outsiders coming together to pull off one big action.
So, Fran, it's been common to say that the book was better than the movie, but what does this movie even have to do with Andreas Malm's book beyond its incendiary title?
It's a very different work. It's fictional, it's a drama narrative. The book is a nonfiction manifesto or polemic. It's not a narrative. And the filmmakers stress that they wanted to make a mainstream genre film that would reach a wider audience than the book had. And the book starts from pointing out that since the Congress of Parties first meeting in 1995, the climate situation has only gotten worse. So clearly the waves of mass climate action and activism has not slowed the pace of the disaster. So something else is needed. wanted is sort of the premise that he starts from. And that idea is similar in the film. Something else is needed. The book has three chapters. The first one takes apart the argument for strategic pacifism that has been popular, particularly with the UK XR movement. And Malm really dismantles the arguments for that, saying that it's not clear that nonviolent action is always more effective. In the second chapter, then he goes on to argue for a kind of radical flank movement. The most famous example of that historically is in the US, the civil rights movement. So Malm sort of argues for the need for a radical flank to push a movement left and to get something done, that the peaceful sort of mainstream of progressive climate activism has not had much positive effect in the big picture. And then he has a last chapter arguing against climate despair and for the need to keep acting in the face of the onrushing disaster. The film is really trying to make a left of mainstream film, but mainstream enough to reach a wide audience. So they've chosen a heist film, which is a kind of ensemble piece. So they've got a group of characters selected as sort of representatives of people who are particularly harmed by the fossil fuel industry and the climate crisis. It's an illustration of why some people might want to blow up a pipeline.
Yeah, each character in the film has a backstory, though, you know, one of the things that's kind of compelling about it as a heist film is that it starts just in the action, in the actual deployment of their bomb building, and the kind of backstory for each character, which is significant, comes in as flashbacks throughout the process of them going out to this site on what was one of the characters' land before a fossil fuel company through eminent domain had taken it from him in order to expand their pipeline. We have a couple different college students who are trying to take action around climate change. They're involved in a campus divestment movement, but then also trying to produce awareness-raising film about those who are impacted by fossil fuel, including the character whose land we go out to in the film. And each character has something to say about the background idea of there being a movement for changing the world for a better place, especially in regards to climate change. And what I think is interesting, but also a little underwhelming about this, is that their characterization of the movement focuses on eco-liberal tactics and strategies that look to existing channels for social change, that stress the incrementalism of social change, that stress the market as a mediator for social action. But ultimately, they are also trying to affect the market by blowing up this pipeline. And there isn't a whole lot of connection to movements beyond how they have cynically turned away from what they feel are ineffective movements.
Yeah, we see some of the characters engaging in low-level sabotage. There's a tire slashing. There are other characters who we see pouring sugar into a gas tank for some equipment. Those are the anarchist or whatever punks from Portland. And then there's a Native American character who's furious at the fossil fuel workers on his people's traditional land. Although the only action we see from his community is his mother is involved in some seed saving project.
The Conservancy.
So we see some efforts in the direction of climate action, but we don't see mass movements. We don't see the Standing Rock occupation. We don't see blockades or any of those actions. We also don't see the characters considering the role of the legal system. The director has said in interviews he's in favor of the importance of the necessity defense for climate action, that it is morally justified and legally justified. And we have seen some success of the necessity defense, for instance, in Portland, where activists planted a garden blocking the trains that Zenith is using to bring in tar sands oil. Their case ended in essentially a hung jury, but most of the jurors were in favor of acquitting them. And the argument for the necessity defense is partly partly that it gets the word out, that it shifts the legal ground available. But there's nothing in the film about, like, nobody seems to have contacted a lawyer. There's very little attention to the larger legal or collective actions that people have taken, might be taking in relation to climate.
The film is trying to make a case for eco-terrorism, and it is somewhat successful in that it portrays everything as going mostly as planned. They, spoiler alert, they don't just show you how to blow up a pipeline, they do it. And they, you know, have several conversations while they're doing this about how they're going to be labeled as terrorists. And in fact, the couple, Logan and Rowan, Rowan is caught when they are trying to sabotage that equipment. And she is basically coerced by the FBI into becoming an informant. And this is one of the less believable, it's less believable that they will trick the FBI, which is what she sets out to do. And then they get involved in this plot by just happening to run into one of the other characters in a bookstore. And, you know, when they're talking about terrorism, they're also making valid points about how when people challenge authority, they get labeled with terrorism. I mean, we had a local experience with this just last month when Portland Association of Teachers, in addition to their rallies in the center of town, had peaceful rallies and pickets in the neighborhoods of some of PPS's management, which the lawyers for PPS challenged this in court by saying that it violated labor law and constituted terrorism. That is like actually in their court filings that this was a terrorist act. So it is worth thinking about how they are trying to face down that fear of doing the right thing is going to get labeled as, you know, the worst kind of evil. And at the same time, they're slipping between the idea of the radical flank as an expression of a larger movement that has other means of power available to it, and somehow leading the movement, being a game changer, as one of the characters refers to the idea of blowing up the pipeline, or revolutionaries. There's this kind of sense of nothing else is going to work, and so we're going to be the spearhead for what will work, and that's just not how it works.
This is definitely not something anyone should take as a guide to how to go about blowing up a pipeline. I mean, I think in the book, the title is maybe an attempt at a kind of rhetorical radical flank. You open it thinking, oh, this is about blowing up pipelines. And then the argument is not that we should be blowing up pipelines, but that we should be engaging in blockades and occupations and mass actions of less incendiary sorts. So I think the book might be using that kind of tactic to move people. The film is not doing the same kinds of thing because it's showing this action of blowing up a pipeline as though it can work this easily. And these people have not taken any consideration to security culture. They're randomly hooking up with other people they meet through videos and in bookstores, and not checking, like, who do you know and how do I know that you're not an informant or a plant or an agent trying to entrap us? Because there is a lot of that out there. And there are all sorts of laws being put on the book about damage to critical infrastructure that heightens the danger of all of these things. So we're not getting any guidance on security culture. I mean, the FBI shenanigans reminded me of the 1973 movie The Sting, which is a light comedy in which there is a similar kind of we tricked the FBI moment in the narrative. And in that, it's light, it's funny, it's not meant to be taken too seriously. But here, it seems like there is perhaps some reason that someone might think you could get away with doing this, and the FBI would not swoop in, arrest everybody before anything got blown up, and lock them away for a really long time.
There's a long history, a century at least, of the bomb-throwing anarchist as this boogeyman of the left. And there is also a real history of anarchists wanting to engage in what was called propaganda of the deed, which in fact involved blowing things up or otherwise trying to cause significant damage that would be a spectacle that would somehow be an inspiration to the masses to wake up. And what we also see, though, in the history of sabotage, which is a word that has a very kind of specific origin in the labor movement. The sabot was the wooden shoe of the Dutch workmen that was apocryphally thrown into the gears as an act of resistance to capitalist modernity. And in the early days of the industrial workers of the world, there was a open embrace of the term sabotage. But in practice, Marxist historian who passed away a couple years ago, Mike Davis, did an incredible historical investigation of the early IWW's praxis around sabotage and shows that rather than being overly focused and single-minded about property destruction as the linchpin of catalyzing revolutionary agency, sabotage was a flexible toolkit of tactics that involved direct engagement with the means of production and the obstruction of that. But it was much more about having the mass capacities of labor at the means of production in control of itself in a way that brought things to a halt. Of course, there were union workers who bombed railroads, but the clandestine organizing that the IWW was doing to withhold their labor in strategic ways that were not a spectacle like the big strikes of the 1930s, and that would become the kind of only weapon that labor was allowed to deploy occasionally after the National Labor Relations Act was passed, that there's a parallel to this history of repressing the real power of mass politics and of the revolutionary agency of the working class realizing that nothing happens without us and we have the power. And so there is something, you know, potentially regressive or reactionary in the film that cynically turns away from that tradition and from that analysis of how power works, that Malm's book, you know, does not make that mistake. It starts with a provocation, but then it's really an entry point into, rather than how do we literally blow up a pipeline, how do we figuratively blow up the pipelines with different kinds of mass actions that put their hands on the means of production.
On the plus side, the film, it's a provocation, it's a discussion prompt. So in that sense, it can be a useful tool as well as an entertaining heist film.
You know, to the filmmaker's credit, they do explicitly direct viewers to their website in order to gain access to the book. And in that way, you know, it can be seen as playing with this idea of the radical flank and working with the realities of mass media and how you get a different kind of audience to check something out that will actually make sense to them if you know how to lead them to it. The film's characters have a lot to say about the weaknesses of the climate movement, and the film itself, I think, gives us an opportunity to think through the weaknesses of a particular kind of pivot away from those politics as normal, those existing channels sorts of means of social change. I think that the takeaway, or one of the takeaways from this film, especially seen in light of the book that it's loosely based off of, is that this kind of dramatic action may be justified, but it is not the leading edge of social change. It is something that has to be in a practical relationship with movements that then deploy those tactics strategically. We need to build the base for power so that if we get to the point where dramatic action is taken, that it doesn't just evaporate after the action. Well, I'm Joe Clement. I've been talking with Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour about the 2022 Climate Action Heist, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. You can find this film on Hulu or for free at your local library on DVD or streaming through the Canopy service. You can get a copy of Andreas Malm's book at the local library or for free as an ebook through the publisher Verso using the code PIPELINE, which you can find through the film's website. Look for links to all of these when the show is posted.
With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, what was once put together, we can easily undo. With bandanas on their faces, careful not to make a sound, they loosened all the bolts
that held the towers to the ground. And several weeks later, with nobody around, the Minnesota wind blew tower after tower after tower down with the turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw. What was once put together, we can easily undo.
You just heard some of Turn of the Wrench by Dana Lyons, and before that, Joe Clement and I discussing the climate action film How to Blow Up a Pipeline. We'll post a longer version of that conversation, along with the IWW song Tarara Boomdie, on the website for this episode. I'm Fran Michel, and I'm your host for today's episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit, independent, non-commercial community radio station. Member-supported means that 80% of the station's funding comes from members, but only about 10% of listeners are members. So let's get a little more mass collective action going here. This is the end-of-the-year campaign. We have just a few more days to meet our $75,000 goal. But now is also a great time to contribute to KBOO because a generous group of KBOO donors will match your gift one-for-one up to $20,000. So please, go to kboo.fm/give or click on the red donate button on the app or the website, or text KBOO to 44321, or mail your check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And then you, too, will be not just a listener, but a listener, member, supporter of one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the oldest media institutions in Portland, part of the city's venerable, truly democratic traditions. For more about the battles to maintain Portland's active, small-d democratic culture, we turn now to guest mole Lauren Goldberg with commentary on how the Portland Metro Chamber of Commerce and business lobbyists undermine ballot initiatives.
Oregon's citizen-initiated ballot measure process allows for activists, organizers, and everyone else to have a say in state and local policy. Not every state allows citizens to engage in this type of grassroots democracy, but Oregonians have used this process to enact sweeping, progressive programs. In 2018, voters passed the Portland Clean Energy Fund, or PCEF. Unlike most climate actions, PCEF was conceived and championed by a coalition of local leaders representing communities of color in the Portland area to invest in climate projects that benefited disadvantaged communities. In 2020, Oregonians passed both Preschool for All and Measure 110, hard-fought and won by people-powered campaigns. Preschool for All began as the Universal Preschool Now campaign, or Up Now, a grassroots campaign led by volunteer organizers. The Multnomah County program was hailed as a national model when it passed, guaranteeing tuition-free, best-practices preschool to every 3- and 4-year-old in the county while simultaneously increasing teacher pay. Also in 2020, voters turned Measure 110 into law, making Oregon the first state to decriminalize possession of otherwise illegal drugs while expanding access to treatment programs. Thanks to the hard work of volunteers on all of these campaigns, Oregon is now home to some of the country's most innovative environmental, early childhood education, and drug enforcement and treatment programs. But there are Oregonians who would rather disregard the will of the voters. The Portland Metro Chamber, also known as the Portland Business Alliance, is a regional association that advocates for the capitalist class. While it claims to speak for all sorts of businesses, its decision makers are far from local mom-and-pop shops. The Chamber's board is full of multinational corporations, commercial real estate companies, banks, and corporate law firms. It also has represented local real estate dynasties like the Schnitzers, the Goodmans, and the Sturgeons. Their lobbying efforts are prolific, meeting with city officials 7 times more than any other organization over the past decade. The Chamber also has close ties to Oregon Business and Industry, a state-level lobbying group, as well as People for Portland. Anonymous People for Portland funders remain a secret, but include billionaires Tim Boyle and Jordan Schnitzer, according to Willamette Week. The Chamber also has ties to Revitalize Portland, chaired by Schnitzer and funded in part by Greg Goodman of the Downtown Development Group. Further complicating the Chamber's relationship to local government, it has worked its way into a number of high-profile public-private partnerships, like Governor Tina Kotek's Central City Task Force, which, like the Chamber, has a tiered sponsored system of large businesses with their own agendas on crucial issues like taxes, police, and housing. Together, these groups pressure elected officials to keep business and wealth taxes low. If it was up to the Portland Business Alliance, Preschool for All never would have made it in front of the voters. Before it was voted into law, it was clear how the measure would be funded. an initial 2.3% tax on taxable income over $125,000 for individuals or over $200,000 for households, a group that makes up the top 5% of income earners in the county. Ballot measure language included a 0.8% increase to the tax rate in 2026. Armed with this knowledge, Multnomah County residents still overwhelmingly voted Preschool for All into law by a nearly 2-to-1 margin. However, the Portland Business Alliance kept Up Now, the grassroots campaign that would eventually become Preschool for All and first suggested funding the program through an income tax, stuck in unsuccessful lawsuits for months, leaving organizers with only 5 weeks to gather the signatures needed to qualify for the ballot. Against all odds, Up Now's volunteer organizers did so, paving the way for the program to be voted into effect. But that wasn't enough to stop the chamber's allies. In January 2021, county commissioners gave up a fifth of the tax revenue to avoid so-called double taxation for business owners that also pay the county's business income tax. Not even 3 years later, the chamber and its allies are at it again. This month, the Central City Task Force recommended a ban on all new taxes until 2026, including the voter-approved increase to the Preschool for All tax, despite the fact that Preschool for All is still in the infancy of its rollout. It will take time and money for the program to be fully implemented as voters intended. But the chamber and its capitalist friends simply don't care if preschool is affordable as much as they care about keeping less than 1% more of their income in their pockets. Using the judicial system to try and stop voters from getting a say about ballot initiatives that would benefit the working class has become a tried and true tactic for the chamber. In 2022, they sued to keep another initiative off the ballot, specifically the charter reform initiative, brought to the ballot by the majority of Portland's Volunteer Charter Commission. The chamber again lost, but continued to fight charter reform through the November 2022 election, when voters approved the measure 58-42%. Also in 2022, the chamber tried to use the courts to keep yet another citizen-led initiative off the ballots. This time, it was Eviction Representation for All, a campaign led by local housing activists. While the legal challenges to Eviction Representation for All also failed, the lawsuit kept housing advocates tied up in court for so long that they were unable to gather the signatures needed in time for the November 2022 election, pushing it instead to May 2023, an election that saw a far smaller voter turnout, leading to the campaign's demise. Of course, the chamber might not care about renters' rights or preschool for those who can't afford private school tuition. Its wealthy members are unlikely to avail themselves of such services. But stunningly, it has also pushed back against PSEF, despite the fact that members cannot outrun climate change. PSEF is funded by a 1% surcharge on local sales at large retailers. The tax has proven to be lucrative, bringing in more money than originally projected. But rather than continue the work endorsed by a majority of Portland's voters, Portland City Commissioners amended the law to allow the additional tax revenue to be used on other city projects. The effort was spearheaded by Carmen Rubio, who met with the chamber's lobbyist as a group and on an individual basis more than 100 times since taking office. While some of the reallocated money will still go to laudable efforts, like the Portland Bureau of Transportation's climate programs, much of the money will also go into private entities outside the communities it was intended to help, including an unspecified amount to the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall and $28 million to the Keller Auditorium. In addition to exerting its influence to override the will of the voters in regard to preschool and the environment, some of the chamber's most public-facing work has been to undermine Measure 110. The original backers of the bill say Measure 110 needs more time, as funding for treatment and harm reduction were not put into place until August 2022. But the chamber and its allies have not been patient. The chamber, as well as affiliates like Downtown Clean and Safe, People for Portland, and the Central City Task Force, never stopped pushing for more quote-unquote security in the central city and downtown, a thinly veiled euphemism for more police, despite the fact that there is no evidence that Measure 110's passing led to an increase in crime. Now, a coalition of powerful business leaders and their political allies are moving ahead with plans to quote-unquote fix Measure 110 by undoing its central tenet, the decriminalization of small amounts of illicit drugs. Some of the state's wealthiest residents, all affiliated with the chamber, are financing this push. Should their lobbying efforts fail in the upcoming February 2024 legislative short session, they plan to bring their policy to the voters through what will surely be a well-funded ballot initiative that the chamber wouldn't dare tie up in courts this time. Luckily, all hope is not lost. The efforts to undermine Measure 110 have not gone unchallenged. Drug Policy Alliance, a national grassroots organization focused on ending the war on drugs, has promised to fight any effort to repeal Measure 110. Up Now's grassroots organizers are not giving up the much-needed tax revenue without a fight. Information about efforts will be posted to their social media. And despite the chamber's best efforts, charter reform did pass in Portland, and in November 2024, citizens will have a chance to choose new members of an expanded 12-seat city council through a ranked choice voting system. Capitalists may never stop trying to undo popular policies, but together, the people can and will fight back.
You're trying to tell me I'm living in democracy. Everyone is always free to either live with ugliness or beauty. You're trying to tell me, undermining revolutions when they threaten institutions is a major power's democratic duty. With Batista, Marcos, Pinochet, you got along, but not with the Sandinistas and not with the Viet Cong. Excuse me, friend, I think you got it wrong. 'Cause when some of us are free to rise and some are free to fall, all of us are under the dictatorship of capital.
That was Alistair Hewlett singing The Dictatorship of Capital. And before that, guest mole Lauren Goldberg discussing how the Portland Metro Chamber of Commerce and the rest of the city's big business lobby try to undermine Democratic Citizen Initiative ballot measures and press forward their dictatorship of capital. But I think they would be wrong. They would be wrong because people and genuinely grassroots groups keep fighting for democracy. They would be wrong because Portland still has truly independent media like KABU, nonprofit, non-commercial, volunteer-powered, member-supported radio that cuts through the clouds of mainstream misinformation. They would be wrong because KABU has trained thousands of people in how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support of KABU members. So thank you, members. And thank you to the generous donor members who are matching your gifts dollar for dollar up to $20,000 in this last week of KABU's end-of-year campaign. We have a few more days to meet our $75,000 goal for this campaign, and you can help us get there by giving what you can, by joining KABU, or by increasing your gift if you're already a member. You can give online through the website at kboo.fm/give, or if you're using the KABU mobile app, just click on the donate button. By SMS, you can text KBOO to 44321, or you can write a check and postal mail it to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. As always, you can find the whole show and its segments with additional links and information, and a longer version of the Movie Moles talk at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Where you can listen again, subscribe, share, and join KABU by clicking on the red donate tab in the upper right corner of the page. Remember that 80% of KABU's funding comes from listeners, and we cannot do this without you. I'm Fran Michel, and I've been your host for this episode, and I could not do this without everyone else at KABU, and especially the other volunteers and guests on today's show. Thanks to Jan Hocken and her guest, Jennifer Ruth, for their conversation about the political assaults on American education. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg for editing and recording assistance. Thanks to Joe Clement for talking with me about the movie How to Blow Up a Pipeline and for playing our theme song and providing other musical aid. Thanks to guest mole Lauren Goldberg for her illumination of some of the who, how, and why of business interests and their lobbyists in Portland trying to obstruct the will of the voters and the grassroots campaigners for a better city. Thanks to all the staff, volunteers, and listener members of KBOO. The Old Mole will be back next Monday with more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's grassroots perspective.
I had a job once, threshing wheat, worked 16 hours with hands and feet. And when the moon was shining bright, they kept me working all the night. One moonlit night, I hate to tell, I accidentally slipped and fell. My pitchfork went right in between the cogwheels of that thresh machine. Ta-ra-ra, boom, da! It made a noise that way, and wheels and bolts and hay went flying every way. That stingy rook said, well, 1,000 shots, hell, I did sleep well that night, I needed it all right. And then that farmer said, you jerk, I'll bet you are and I won't work. He paid me off right then, by gum. So I went home and told my chum. Next day when threshing did commence, my chum was Johnny on the fence. And upon my word, that awkward kid, he dropped his pitchfork like I did. Tarara boom, yay! It made a noise that way. And part of that machine hit Reuben on the beam. He cried, oh me, oh my, I nearly lost an eye. My partner said, that's right, it's bedtime now, good night. Pretty wise, these things did open up his eyes. He said, there must be something wrong. I think I work my men too long. He cut the hours and raised the pay, gave ham and eggs for every day. Now gets his men from union halls, has no accidents at all. Tarara boom, yay, that Rube is feeling gay. He learned his lesson quick through just a simple trick. For fixing rotten jobs and curing greedy slobs, this is the only way. Tarara boom, yeah. This is the only way. Tarara boom, yeah.
KBOO Portland.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Help! KBOO Community Radio is listener supported. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. Right now, during our annual end-of-year campaign, your support can go even farther. Contribute today at kboo.fm/give and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Maximize the impact of your support for KBOO right now.
Want to be in the know for all things Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com for all the newest episodes and up.